Is it because they are working now with the Agile DevOps, or is it because the internal communication is better? But what I think that is that the communication is, like, in a way, is the byproduct of the Agile or DevOps processes. But could be that this byproduct made the difference and not necessarily the process themselves.
On this episode of Embedded Insiders, we're joined by Yaniv Amy, the CEO of PractiTest. The software development company is focused on providing end-to-end test management solutions, and it is also the creator of the annual State of Testing report. And Inni is here to share some of this year's most notable findings. Then, on Dev Talk with Rich and Vin, the two are discussing AI and machine learning with Kashal Vora, a senior director at Renesas. Kashal works with suppliers in this space and is lending a hand in the creation of an AI ecosystem, which some say already exists, and others say that developers should wait before diving in. But first, the insiders discuss the growing impact electrification has on the mobility industry. Specifically, the trends and challenges surrounding electric vehicles, and whether EV infrastructure and businesses can keep up with the demand.
Hello and welcome to the Embedded Insiders. I'm Brandon Lewis, Editor-in-Chief of Embedded Computing Design, and I'm here with Rich Nass, who's the EVP and Brand Director of Embedded Computing Design. How are you, Rich?
I am very good, thank you. I'm just back from a trip and trying to catch up.
Where did you go?
I went to the same place I always go. It seems like I went to Silicon Valley. I had a whole bunch of good meetings there, and lots of traffic, so I guess our industry's back. You keep hearing about layoffs, but unless these people are on their way to job interviews, it was pretty crowded. So it was a lot of traffic on the usual roads.
Oh, the old electric vehicle valley. Every other
there are definitely more electric vehicles there than any place else, that's for sure. And not only that, there's all the unusual electric vehicles, you know. Where I live here, you just see Teslas everywhere. But there you got all the Rivians and all the other weird looking ones that I don't even remember the names of.
I remember, you know, before the pandemic, when you would go to the Valley, you wouldn't even see Teslas. That it was pretty rare to see a Tesla outside of the Bay Area, but then you would go to the Bay Area and literally every other car was a Tesla. So
you know, they call that time period now BC, before COVID.
That's a dad joke if I ever heard one. So actually, I think that there's a stat about electric vehicles and the proliferation of them, or the attempted proliferation of them, as we try to hit our climate goals or the climate goals set for.
What do you mean attempted?
What?
You said attempted.
Well, our producer, Tiara Oliver, who's also an associate editor at Embedded Computing Design.
So I was just doing some research last week, and I saw that the government is now allowing those, or giving those who qualify, a credit of up to $7,500 if you buy a new plug-in electric vehicle or a fuel cell electric vehicle. Has to be for your own use and used primarily in the U.S. And of course, there's a bunch of other stipulations, but.
You know, I saw something similar the other day where they were given money if you bought a used one. Really? It was $4,000 credit if you bought a used EV.
They should probably give you higher credit than for a new one, because those things are all, it's 100% battery, right? Your battery doesn't have the capacity it once did, you're kind of SOL.
Yeah, you know, it is kind of funny because the replacement cost for the batteries could be like $15,000.
Exactly.
But we don't have enough data to really tell us how long these batteries are going to last. Somebody I know recently bought a used one. I think, what did he buy? Like it was an 18 or a 19 Tesla. And he said his test showed that the degradation was less than 10%. Which is really good.
Yeah, it is really good. But the thing that So I'm not sure if we've broached this topic before, but my grandfather passed away recently, and he was a huge proponent of climate, clean energy, clean everything. And he bought a Nissan Leaf, but he bought a used Nissan Leaf. And the issue with it is that the battery degraded to the point where I think they could only go like 90 miles on a charge.
How much did it go when it was new? Do you know?
I don't know. But 90 miles. So they live in Tucson. I live in Phoenix. And that means you would have to stop halfway between Phoenix and Tucson, which for anybody who knows that drive, it's a 2-hour drive at the most, at the very, very most.
Yeah, but so, they have nothing better to do.
well, actually, the big problem is there's not a whole lot between Tucson and Phoenix. So I'm not sure if there are a whole lot of electric vehicle chargers anywhere between Tucson and Phoenix. So my point being, to your comment, that 10% degradation, I mean, depending on where you're starting from, you know, in terms of range, could be a big deal.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. It didn't seem like, you know, if you're getting 400 miles and you're down 40 miles, it's not really that big of a deal.
Yeah, that's true. But if you're getting 200 miles and you go to 180, now that starts being a little bit.
Well, the older vehicles didn't have the fast charging capability either. With the newer ones, you could put that thing up there for 20 minutes and get yourself to like 80%.
Yeah, but isn't that only at home? Do they even have that capability widespread?
Yes, they do. Yep.
So I know that ChargePoint is one of the leading EV charging infrastructure companies out there. But at least here in Phoenix, it's still a big issue that there are not a lot of public places that you can charge your EV.
Well, speaking of degradation, Phoenix is probably the worst place to own one of these things because the worst characteristic is the heap.
Yeah, that and it being so spread out that there's actually not a lot of, there's not a good way to add charging stations either, just because it's so dispersed.
So is that the next business for us? We're going to install charging stations?
I think we should. But I want us to have uniforms. Like, and our uniforms have to come with a hat, like a train conductor's hat or something. And we'll be out there in the sun installing EV charging stations.
You mean like Gomer Pyle?
Yeah, exactly. Are you ready to buy an electric vehicle anytime soon, Rich?
Actually, I am. I have a lease that's got about another 10 months on it. And I'm just starting to think about what my next vehicle is going to be. And I'm strongly considering an EV.
Anyone in particular?
I didn't get that far yet. I'm very disappointed. I don't know if I should say this or not, but I'll say it anyway. My last two leases were Lexuses. Is that the plural of Lexus?
I think it's Lexi.
Lexi. Anyway, and I really enjoy the car a lot, but they are not at the forefront of EV technology, and they don't have the model that I have available in an EV, and it won't be at least till 2025, which I can't wait that long because it's a lease. So I may have to explore others. But I don't know.
So I, as everybody who knows me know, I'm a drive it till it explodes kind of guy. And I've got a car for 8 or 9
years. Well, I've seen the way you drive, and sometimes that doesn't take very long.
But the, my next car will be an electric vehicle. And I've actually, since I've got a place up north, I was thinking maybe I could get a Model S or something like that, but now I'm thinking I probably need a high-profile sport utility vehicle so I can get around up there in the winter. And Jeep, which is my favorite car of all time, recently announced that they have a 4x4, an all-electric 4x4 Grand Cherokee that's coming out. So I'm going to look into that. But this brings me back to one of the things that we always talk about, which is, do I want to be the guy in the first-gen all electric Jeep Grand Cherokee 4x4 stuck out in the winter in the middle of nowhere?
Yeah, I'm not that concerned about that one, because the issue there is the charging electrical system itself. And I get that it's first for them, but it's not first for the company. You know, that's a pretty big company. Jeep is just one division of Chrysler, Daimler, and you know, and they've done that in other vehicles. They're all on the same assembly line. If you look at the dash of a Jeep, it's the same dash that's in a Chrysler.
When was the last time you owned a Chrysler?
Well, I actually, I am also a big Jeep guy, and I've owned Jeeps. I have a Jeep now, and it's about a year old, and it replaced a Jeep behind it.
Actually, I have a Chrysler right now, and it's been pretty good. I've heard a bunch of horror stories from, you know, self-proclaimed car enthusiasts that Chryslers are crappy cars, but I don't know.
Hey, watch your mouth.
Crappy?
It's a family show.
If the families, I don't know what kind of families you're dealing with, but I'm interested to see how a lot of these traditional car companies are going to make this transition and how successfully they'll make the transition into EVs, because you know, they've been holding off on this for a long, long time.
Well, many of them are in that mode of, I won't produce an internal combustion engine in the year 2030. I've heard that a bunch of times from a few of the different companies.
Of the big ones?
Yeah.
Like of the automakers themselves?
Yes.
Yeah, well, that would be pretty remarkable. I just, and again, back to something we were talking about earlier, if that's the case, we better get a move on retrofitting a bunch of these gas stations, because to my point earlier, 50% of these charge point chargers don't work. You know, if you don't have a fast charger, all these things are just, consumers will just not accept this, right? Like if you went up to a gas station and 20% of the time the pump didn't work, man, I mean, it'd be like the air compressors, you know, like might as well just take it to the tire shop, because the air compressors are all busted everywhere in the country, apparently. But that was the same for gas. I mean, people just won't have it.
Yeah, 20% not working is a lot, because there aren't that many. It isn't like gas stations where they're on every corner.
Right, exactly. So we'll see. I don't know if the industry is going to be able to scale some of this new SICK and GAN stuff, you know, some of the controllers that are going to be needed for the EV charging infrastructure. All that stuff's really got to get a move on at a time when we're just coming through, you know, this component shortage and supply chains are being reoriented. So fingers crossed.
Now, Yaniv Eni, CEO of PractiTest, gives insight into the company's most recent state of testing report, specifically the biggest findings affecting testers and test practices.
Can you give us some background on the PractiTest state of testing report this year, how the report data is collected, and how many participants you had in this year's report?
This is the 10th report, so we're doing it for a while. The main idea of it was and still is to be part of the largest testing community around the world, whether they are directly connected to us in PractiTest, which is like clients or partners. When we first initiated the state of testing and we started the list, we did it with other community bloggers, and we asked people to elaborate and to share this survey, and we get all the results from the survey. And now there's a huge list of thousands of people that are part of the state of testing community. Not all of them are answering every year, but it's a little bit, it's between 1,000 and 2,000 people from around the world. Most of them are related to the state of testing and we're part of it for a while, but each year we add more people to it. So we want to have a community related scope of what is really going on.
So this year had a new section on agile and DevOps testing. Can you share some of the biggest findings in this section?
Yeah, one interesting finding is that above 90% of the organization are already applying some sort of agile or DevOps processes. And this year, from the respondent that we had, more than 50% of them were actually part of the DevOps teams. And that was about 40% last year. So we see a huge increase in that process. And for me, another interesting note that I saw is that most of the people agree that the one of the benefits related to internal communication between the developers and testers. And if you look at it, the actual testing work is today, which related to the Agile and DevOps, they say that it's more organized and overall release products are more stable. So, you know, you can ask, is it because they are working now with the Agile DevOps or is it because the internal communication is better? But what I think that is that the communication is like, in a way, is the byproduct of the Agile or DevOps processes, but it could be that this byproduct made the difference and not necessarily the process themselves.
So another important finding was a decrease in the number of testers. Can you give us some of your thoughts on this decline?
Yes, so I'm not sure that it's a real decrease in the number of testers, but it's definitely a decrease in the number of testers per team. So it could be related that the testers before were distributed, were, you know, different distributed between the teams. There were testers and there were developers. It could be that some of the people which are doing testing are not pure testers because they're doing some development, some automation, but we're not seeing a reduction of testers in the world. Actually, we see an increase of number of testers in the numbers, but what we don't see is that the teams are getting larger, but the teams themselves are getting smaller. So it could be that each project has less testers, by the way, could be as well as less developers, but we're seeing more and more projects that requiring testing. So the absolute numbers are actually increasing.
Were there any other surprising testing practices and or challenges that were reported this year?
We expected a broader involvement of non-dedicated testers to the testing efforts, but the number even decreased a bit this year. It used to be that 15% didn't do any testers at all, but now 90% of the development team is not doing testing at all. Because we see testers are moving into development, we expect a lot of more developers doing testing, so we expect that number to increase, but we saw a slight decrease.
In your opinion, how do you think the industry needs to proceed in the environment of fewer testers leveraging Agile and DevOps workflows?
So I think that everybody should embrace a change. I mean, these technology changes and processes are not something that we can fight or we should fight. You know, and all the Agile and DevOps later on came and shook the testing industry is because of the automation gave us the ability to release fast and see what's going on before doing a whole testing suite, manual testing suite. And this is the major part of the Agile workflow. But, you know, we look at the Agile and we look at the DevOps a few years ago, and maybe we didn't have a section about it, but we saw it was coming and we saw it was increasing. What people should look at, and this is probably not news, is if what we've seen Agile DevOps about 10 years ago, 5 years ago, we probably see starting in the AI, effect that we do the testing world. So if I would need to compare DevOps or Agile 5 to 6 years ago, it's probably what we see now in an AI. We have many of tools, including practice that add AI to the product. And I don't think that we even now can know how the AI will affect the industry. I think that everybody should think what are the opportunities that comes from it. And definitely it's going to be more challenging and different than what we are doing today. So if you look, by the way, of the skill set that needs a tester, everybody, I think it was about 90% that said that one of the most important skills is communication to the testers. And if you are able to embrace the change, it should be good, but the needs will be changing.
Do you have any resources where our listeners can go to find more information about the PRACTITEST 2023 State of Testing Report?
Sure. So they can go to practice.com and just click on the State of Testing there, and you can see all the previous years of the State of Testing. Most of them are translated to other languages as well. And you know, there are tons of data there regarding other things that we do. There's a resource tab and online test conference that we're doing once a year, which is totally free for everybody. We bring great lecturers from around the testing world so they can get more information about the state of testing or any other testing related information.
Now, Rich, Vin, and Kasia Vora, Senior Director at Renesas, discuss the early stages of the AI and machine learning ecosystems, specifically how far these technologies have come and how much further they must go before they're fully mature.
Good afternoon. Welcome to another edition, actually a special edition of Dev Talk with Rich and Vin. I am Rich, and the guy that you can't see, but I can see, is Vin. How you doing, Vin?
Great, Rich. How are you?
I am doing just fine. Thank you very much. So this is a special edition of Dev Talk with Rich and Vin. And you say, well, why is this a special edition, Rich?
Why is this a special edition, Rich?
Because we have a special guest. Our special guest is Kaushal Vora, and he is a senior director at Renesas. How you doing, Kaushal?
I'm great. I'm feeling so special today. Thanks. It's a pleasure to be in the company of both of you. Thank you for having me.
You know, I think you're actually our first guest. Is that right, Ben?
Yeah. He's our first guest. So you have special honors.
I'm really honored today.
Okay. Well, set the bar high. Okay. All right.
Lower now, right?
There you go. So we want to talk about artificial intelligence, machine learning. And I know, Kaushal, you know a lot about that. I know you do as well, Ben. But the where I want to take this, I take this. These discussions in this direction all the time because it applies to a lot of stuff we do. No matter how great your technology is, if you don't have the ecosystem to back it up, you're not getting anywhere. We talk about this with MCUs. We've actually talked about it with RISC-V for a real long time, but it certainly applies to AIML. So as one of the guys who's pretty advanced in AIML, Kaushal, what do you have to say about what exists today in the ecosystem?
Yeah, so the AIML piece that we are referring to really is, you know, there's just so much hype around ChatGPT and, you know, generative AI, and a lot of people associate AIML with that. But really what there's also a lot of exponential opportunity in what we call tiny machine learning, which is basically AIML that gets squeezed into smaller compute nodes, right? So, I mean, what's really driving this is, you know, the maturity that we're seeing in IoT. You know, IoT has been around for about a decade now. And then we're seeing a lot of maturity in machine learning and underlying capabilities of hardware to execute machine learning workloads, right? But what's more important, right? IoT really made people realize the complexity in software, right? And therefore it drove an ecosystem around software that basically had to be driven for enabling, you know, system level capabilities. Like you want to add security to your device, or you want to add, you know, really good human machine interfacing to your device, a nice graphics package to your device. So IoT has a pretty robust ecosystem today, right? Most semiconductor companies have, you know, a large ecosystem that's focused on software building blocks that allow customers to basically adopt and build their systems and make them IoT ready, right? What's happening with AI, right? While IoT is really a very strong connected network for as such, there's still very limited capabilities for devices to think for themselves. So what's happening now is we're having some very interesting evolutions in the industry, whether it's hardware companies trying to evolve their hardware to support AI machine learning workloads, or there are software companies that are basically enabling tools for engineers to take data and to basically create models that can basically run on these devices. Or there are other companies that are evolving around, you know, how do you actually collect, you know, the right data set for your machine learning? Or how do you actually, you know, once your model gets deployed in the field, how do you make sure that the model is continuing to stay healthy, right? So there's a lot of evolution, I would say, in the ecosystem around AI and ML as far as tiny ML is concerned, right? Semiconductor players like Renesas are driving a lot of this around their products. What we're doing is we're innovating on the hardware side, adding acceleration features on our hardware, but then we're also driving our ecosystems around the space, especially, you know, people that provide tool chains to make, you know, the developer journey easy, people that specialize in creating data sets, people that specialize in ML ops, so on and so forth, right? So it's immensely important to have a strong ecosystem around AI and machine learning. But I think we're in the early stage, and I think a lot more has to happen before we can say we're at that maturity level.
Okay, before I let you answer, Ben, real quick, the difference between ML and tiny ML.
So tiny ML is ML that can be squeezed into really tiny space device, resource constrained devices, right?
Okay.
And that's the main difference.
Okay, hence the name tiny.
Yeah.
Ben, I know you're chomping at the bit here.
I am chomping at the bit. So I agree with everything that Kaushal said, and he was a little humble when he talked about the ecosystem growing around IoT and software modules. His company actually spearheaded that in the industry, with really creating not just example code, but code that can be used in final solutions. And many of the other companies in the industry followed suit in various ways. So I look at this really in two ways, because my brain is too simple to look at it in total. When you think about the right brain and the left brain in the human brain, the right brain is looking at images and doing parallel processing. The left side of the brain is doing serial processing. And when you look at AI that's happening, we hear a lot about neural networks. We hear a lot about image processing. We hear a lot about voice processing. And these all, as Kaushal said, require some special hardware in place to accelerate it in silicon. And especially if you want to do it on like an MCU or something that's not connected, certainly. And there are plenty of companies doing that work. And I'm sure, somewhere in the bowels of design, Renesas is doing that work as well. But what's interesting about what I'm seeing on what I'm calling the left brain side of AI, which doesn't get a lot of press, is the ability to process serial information from things like sensors and stuff like that. And that's more of what I would call a left brain process. And that functionality is already built into a lot of processors that are out there, because you could do that if you know what you're doing with DSP techniques. And DSP extensions exist on the ARM architecture, which is the most popular architecture these days, and exists in even some of the instruction sets for some proprietary processors like the RX from Renesas. So you can do that kind of processing in a way that makes it AI already without having to wait for some special silicon to do just the thing that you want to do. And for many systems, you and I talked about this in an earlier podcast, when you try to define what an embedded system is, it is understanding the physical environment around it and doing something to affect it, like a thermostat, measuring temperature and turning heat on and off, as a very simple example. And so small MCUs are perfect for that. And you need to have some kind of AI processing that can fit in that model, hence the whole tiny ML stuff, some of which is image and neural network, but a lot of it can be reduced to this serial processing, but in a different way than you would do it algorithmically with just if then else conditional statements for conditional pathways through your code.
Yeah. Before I forget, you mentioned voice processing, and you guys are starring in a webcast to discuss adding voice processing to your system, and that is on May 3rd. There's a link to that in the description of this podcast. I didn't want to forget that.
He's starring. I'm a supportive role. So
yeah, that's. I mean, Vin made some really good points, right? I mean, he talked about a bulk of the misconception in the market today is when you think about AI, it's often synonymized with deep learning, right? And deep learning is just one part of AI and machine learning, especially as far as tiny ML is concerned, right? Most IoT devices don't have the ability to see or talk, right? They don't have cameras because they're very, very power constrained devices. Most sensor nodes, the billions and billions and billions of sensor nodes that we talk about in IoT don't even have the ability to see, right? So most of the machine learning techniques that tend to get used in non-visual sensing applications tend to be DSP heavy, right? Tend to be based on signal processing and signal conditioning math, right? And the other important thing to understand with machine learning, again, this is a misconception. A lot of people think about designing the most effective machine learning model, but creating a machine learning model is only, in my view, 5% of the problem. The bigger problem is when you actually collect the data, are you collecting data in a way that is robust and is effective? And secondly, once you've collected the data, which aspects of the data that you need to look at and focus on? You know, you might realize 90% of your data set doesn't really do much in terms of, you know, intelligence, right? It's that one threshold change that you're looking for in a signal, which might say, okay, this now means black versus white, right? So there's a concept called feature extraction. So basically what it means is you extract the features from a data set, and then you focus your model building on those features. And that's where a lot of innovation is happening in the ecosystem. And you know, even internally at Renesas is building algorithmic feature extraction capabilities in tools so that you can really build efficient machine learning models. That's what makes it fit in really small machines, right?
Isn't the beauty of this technology, even if you don't start with the right models, it's learning over time. Eventually, it might take longer, but eventually it'll get to where you want to be.
Often a lot of these tools don't, you know, in the end, the engineer doesn't care how you solve the problem, right? I'm not saying that I want to solve this problem just using this particular type of model because it sounds good. Most tools will do that abstraction in the background, right? Most tools will be able to figure out which is the right model to use for a particular use case. Where a lot of the ecosystem lacks today, and a lot of the tools don't do this very well today, is they just take a data set blindly and start figuring out which model to apply on it without doing intelligent feature extraction. And I think that's where, from an ecosystem standpoint, that brings me back to your ecosystem question. The ecosystem is growing, but there's also a lot of companies that, you know, in my view, are doing things that they don't fully understand. A lot of that will get weeded out as the industry matures. But, you know, this is the fun of being in an emerging space is, you know, there's a lot of noise out there. And then there are, you know, a few of these companies that are really doing some hardcore work that is very interesting.
Okay, we're just about out of time. I'm going to put you both on the spot. Is the ecosystem ready now for a designer to jump in and do his design, or should he be waiting another 6 months, 9 months, 12 months?
I mean, the ecosystem is absolutely ready. There's a lot of investments happening from large semiconductor companies like ours to prop up that ecosystem. It does require a little bit of guidance and handholding right now, because that's less to do with ecosystem, more to do with, you know, just people not being comfortable using AI and machine learning coming from the embedded space. But the ecosystem is ready right now. It's been ready for a long time, and I think it'll evolve over time.
Yeah, okay. I think it's ready, and it's ready in its infancy, which means it's ready to grow. And it's only going to grow if people are in there playing with it and trying things. You know, Rich, and you're in my tenure because we're a little older than Kaushal. We've seen software engineering and software engineering techniques transition dramatically from what it was 30 years ago to what it is now, and that's because we got into it in its infancy and people were trying to use electrical engineering ways to solve things in software, and they realized it was a completely different engineering discipline, and that matured and we had to mature along with it. And I think this part of software engineering, which really honestly in most cases is a combination of software and hardware engineering, you know, people, the hardware guys shouldn't get nervous, and you know, this whole feature extraction idea isn't new. If you think about it in digital logic terms, you might have, you know, 25 digital lines, and after you do your minimization, you realize that 20 of them are don't care, what we would call don't cares in digital logic vernacular. So it's a very similar thing, right? You're taking 120 lines of data and you realize that only these three are needed to be able to detect a certain condition. So the engineering process is the same. And I think that it's so young, especially in the tiny ML space, which is where our listenership in the embedded world is. It's just starting and growing, and any one of us can give input.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. This was very educational, and I look forward to expanding on this. And Kaushal, you did set the bar pretty high for the next guest.
Awesome.
Thank you. Awesome.
That was Kasha Vora. He is a senior director with Renesas, and you know me and Ben. Have a good day, everybody.
Bye-bye, guys.
Thanks for listening to this edition of Embedded Insiders. For more daily news, videos, and podcasts, visit our website at embeddedcomputing.com.